In order to eliminate the unemployment, you need a fall in wage rates, but that is prevented by such things as minimum wage and pro-union legislation. And such legislation exists on the foundation of beliefs that in their absence, the standard of living of the average worker would be minimum subsistence. And I think we've dealt with that now. There are some loose ends to wrap up, place a different interpretation on the economic history of the last 200 years. Yes, Mr. Woody?
As far as the unions, maybe the way I think about it is what you're saying about trying to increase, you know, the standard of living for the workers and stuff like that is maybe originally true, but it seems like they've gotten so powerful, and the pension money that the workers have to put in per hour and the dues they have to pay, and there's just so many of them, that the union is becoming so powerfully rich with money and being able to invest and make more money and, you know, be able to have a lot more power than, you know, rather than, I think it would be very hard for that to change because they are so powerful at this point.
Pardon me?
Declining.
Yeah, they are declining, but it is true the unions still have considerable power. But what gives them their power is the thinking of the general public. The unions have power because the public considers them as existing in the vital self-interest of the average worker and believes that in their absence, the standard of living of the average worker would plunge towards subsistence, and that the unions have major responsibility for conditions having improved in the past. That's what people believe. And that conception of things is what I'm trying to challenge. Because that rests on the view that wages are arbitrarily set at minimum subsistence if there are no unions or other government intervention. I think I've refuted that and then shown that what raises real wages is the rise in the productivity of labor. If money wages are not arbitrary, if they're determinate, and then we have improvements in the productivity of labor operating on the side of prices, what must be happening to real wages? If the rise in the productivity of labor is reducing prices relative to money wages, what has to be happening to real wages? They're rising. That's how real wages rise. Now, if you recognize that it's the productivity of labor that is the essential determinant of real wages, and in fact, we can show this algebraically. I have it in the supplement in a few simple steps. Starting with the average real wage, what the worker's money wages can actually buy is W over P, the average money wage divided by the price level. And then we have these two formulas in equations 2 and 3. Well, what happens if we substitute equations 2 and 3 into equation 1? Well, then we have 4, the average real wage is equal to the demand for labor over the supply of labor, that's the average money wage, divided by the demand for consumers' goods over the supply of consumers' goods, that's the price level. When we're dividing by a fractional expression, we follow the rule of inverting and multiplying. That's what we get in equation 5. So the average real wage is equal to demand for labor over supply of labor times the supply of consumers' goods over the demand for consumers' goods. And then all we do in reaching 6 is we change the order of multiplication. We move the demand for consumers' goods under the demand for labor and the supply of labor under the supply of consumers' goods. Well, this is the average real wage. It's equal to the product of these two expressions. What is this? What does the supply of consumers' goods relative to the supply of labor represent? The productivity of labor. The more that the average unit of labor produces, the higher is the supply of consumers' goods relative to the supply of labor. And real wages are the mathematical product of the productivity of labor times this further expression, the demand for labor relative to the demand for consumers' goods. And if you want to understand why real wages were miserably low in previous generations and what allowed them to rise, well, all you have to do is think of what was the state of the productivity of labor? What was the productivity of labor around 1800? It was miserably low. Most of the goods that we take for granted hadn't even been invented yet. And the methods of producing whatever was available were very, very primitive. If you have people growing food, and the only way they can grow it is at best using horse-drawn plows, and in many cases, people-drawn plows, if when they're constructing housing, they have to fell the logs with axes, and then they have to saw them laboriously into planks with saws, when they're making clothing, if they have to weave things by hand, well, how much are they able to produce? Not very much. And there's no such thing as electricity, air conditioners, television sets, telephones, computers, antibiotics, x-ray machines, the whole slew of things. None of that was present. And so the standard of living was miserably low because hardly anything was being produced. But most people, it seems, aren't aware of that. They have a theory, according to what they say so often, that the reason the standard of living was so low was because the greedy capitalists had too much and the average worker didn't have enough. There was an unjust distribution. Isn't this what you hear so often?
Yes.
Okay, well, does that mean that the reason the average worker in 1800 or 1900 didn't have a television set was because the greedy pig capitalists had all the television sets?
Yeah.
And they had all of the refrigerators and freezers and air conditioners. I mean, this is pure, absolute nonsense. The reason that the average person had so little was that so little was being produced. And what improved things was the rise in the productivity of labor, made possible by the greedy pig capitalists. They were the ones who were introducing the improvements in products and methods of production to make profits, and that's what raised the general standard of living. Yes, Mr. Davis.
How does the focus on corporate profits come into play in a bigger scheme? We talk about production being increased, mm-hmm. which leads to real wages going up, higher, mm-hmm. all these positive things that take place.
Mm-hmm.
In the real world today, many people view that corporate America is greedy, focused on profits, mm-hmm. rising wages for CEOs and otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
What happens when instead of those monies going back to lower prices, they're skimmed off the top by the greedy capitalists?
Okay, let's say the greedy capitalists are getting the profits. Now, the key question is, what are they doing with the profits?
They're buying things.
Like what? Are they, to the extent they're reinvesting the profits, what does that show up as? That's more means of production to expand the supply of goods that everybody buys.
So it's a trickle-down theory.
Well, no, it's not trickle-down. You see, trickle-down is an expression used by opponents of the process, and they think, yeah, we'll stand there and a few drops will fall, maybe something will drop into our mouth. It's not trickle-down, it's the way you increase production and improve the standard of living. See, how do you do it? You have to save and reinvest. You have to have improved improved equipment, more advanced methods of production. And what it takes is saving and reinvestment. That's an essential requirement. That and technological progress. That's the only way it can be done. Now, people who characterize this as trickle-down, that's disparaging the process. What is their alternative? What is their theory as to how you raise the standard of living?
Increase wages.
Okay, you go and you seize the profits, you seize the wealth, give it to the workers. That's their idea. But where does the money that you'd be redistributing, what is that? Where does that come from in terms of actual wealth?
It's back to inflation.
Well, to the extent that you'd be taking wealth, the wealth of the rich capitalist is in the means of production. And if the idea is you'll raise the standard of living by seizing the capital and enabling people to consume it, well, that represents a policy of eating the seed corn. That's not how you achieve progress. That's how you achieve impoverishment. And an essential reason that we had economic progress, that it came about in Great Britain and the United States, was because these were two countries where there was a major respect for private property, where the law could not seize the wealth of the citizens. There's a statement I read recently by some prominent English writer back in the 18th century saying describing someone's home, some poor person's home. The wind may enter, the rain may enter, but the King of England and all of his officers, they may not enter. And that principle applied to private property in general. Private property was sacred, and that meant you didn't have to worry about the government interfering with what you were doing and the wealth you were accumulating. And when people were seeking to accumulate wealth, they did so by starting to build factories and invest in equipment that raised the productivity of labor. That is what raised the standard of living. I mean, I hope you realize that the standard of living was not improved by the government seizing the mountains of food from the fat capitalists and distributing it to the starving peasants. The food wasn't produced, still less the automobiles, air conditioners, television sets, etc. All of these things were brought to the market by the capitalists. And that's what served to shorten the working day and improve working conditions. So you just think, if you have a miserably low productivity of labor, but people have certain absolutely essential requirements, and they produce very little per hour, what must they do to compensate? They have to work very long hours. The long hours were the accompaniment of the low productivity of labor. And child labor was the accompaniment of the low productivity of labor. And these things pre-existed the development of capitalism. That was the norm throughout all of history. And when capitalism began, it started improving things from a miserably, miserably low base. Yes, Mr. Richards.
We read any of Charles Dickens' books back in Victorian England, books about the poor and how there were so many little kids, chimney sweeps.
Mm-hmm.
Was that, I mean, what's your feeling on that in terms of capitalism? Was that pure capitalism, or was the government involved and that's why we had these poor kids climbing down chimneys?
Well, there weren't children working as chimney sweeps, and around 1800 or 1790, there were some children even working in mines, and that's genuinely a horrible situation. But that wasn't the result of the capitalists. That was the result of a miserably low productivity of labor, a state of affairs where there were not even any steam engines. By 1820, there were only 300 steam engines in all of Great Britain. So people were miserably, miserably poor. They had to produce something, and the only way they could do it was by working horrendously long hours and having their children work
basically,
too.
Basically, there wasn't enough work for the amount of people, is that what you're saying?
No, there was more work than they could do.
Oh, okay.
They needed to work more because they're producing so little per hour. Just think, suppose you must have 10 units of something, and you can only produce 1 unit per hour. Well, doesn't that imply that you need to work 10 hours? If you indispensably needed 12 or 13 units, that would imply you'd need to work 12 or 13 hours, right? Now, the reason people were working so long is they were producing so little per hour, and that's why they needed the help of their children in many cases. Now, what happened as improved methods of production were introduced and newer, better products, what did this do to real wages? If you grant the principles in our discussion before the break, if it's the case that improvements in the productivity of labor raise real wages, then as they begin to occur, the first steam engines were introduced in, I think, 1776 by Watt, and they were applied to the weaving of cloth, and cloth became much, much cheaper. For the first time in human history, poor people could afford such things as new underwear. Prior to that, people were wearing all clothes, second, third, and fourth hand. They were lice infested. The main fabric in clothing was wool. You couldn't wash it very often, it would destroy it. They were living in miserable squalor. No such thing as indoor plumbing, ventilation, no electricity, nothing of this kind. So the standard of living for the immense majority of people was absolutely horrendous. And even the very richest were miserably poor by our standards. One of the things my mentor used to point out is he would have liked it very much if when American soldiers were stationed in France, some of them had been made to spend the night in the Palace of Versailles. they would have found that there was no indoor plumbing in the Palace of Versailles. If Queen Victoria broke an arm, could she get an x-ray? If someone got pneumonia, could they get an antibiotic? No. Could Queen Victoria ride in an automobile or an airplane or turn on a television set? No. These rich people, they had some beautiful structures. They had a lot of servants. They had some fancy furniture and draperies and such. But they were poor in all other respects compared to the average wage earner of the present day. Now, if it's the case that people have certain essential requirements, and when we begin, they're working to their utmost to meet them, well, what happens as the productivity of labor and real wages rise? We started off, let's say people were working 80 hours a week. Now imagine it's a generation or so later, there's been some significant progress, the productivity of labor has doubled. What's the effect on the average real wage? Okay, it should have doubled too. Now, when the average real wage reaches the point where it's twice the level of subsistence, then do people need to work 80 hours in order barely to survive?
No.
No, they don't. Now they're in a position where if they wish, they could work less. If you work less, you will earn less. But if you can now earn double subsistence, well, the large numbers of workers might prefer to have 7/8 of doubled subsistence, work a 70-hour week instead of an 80-hour week. They can afford the comparatively lesser earnings of the shorter week. Why? Because the rise in the productivity of labor has raised their real wages. Well, the way the work week shortens is by virtue of the real wages of more and more workers rising to the point where they can afford to accept the comparatively lower earnings of a shorter week. And then, if that's their preference, what would you expect to be the effect on the wages that would have to be paid to induce people to work 80 hours rather than 70 hours? There'd have to be a premium built in to the 80-hour wages, a kind of built-in overtime, and a discount on the more preferred shorter-hour jobs. It's the same as any job that's considered more favorable compared to other jobs, how will that affect the relative wages? Okay, we have the wage of sewer workers versus the wages of someone working in a comfortable office. Which do you think, if the skill set were the same, which do you think the sewer workers have to be paid more to compensate for the hardship of their job? The comfortable setup will pay less. Well, when real wages rise, more and more workers are in a position to afford to accept a discount for the comparatively greater comfort of shorter hours. What does that do to the profitability of offering shorter hours? Suppose you can now get workers, you could offer an 80-hour week or you could offer a 70-hour week, but the 70-hour week, you only have to pay 66% of what you pay, then it's cheaper to have the shorter week. Plus, there's the fact that if people are very, very tired at the end, they're not going to produce all that much in any case. So the market operates to bring about a shorter week, irrespective of legislation. And when you have legislation, if the legislation gets ahead of the market, then what is the effect? Imagine we had a law imposing a 30-hour week now. I'd like to see just 30 hours. I'm sure we'd all prefer to work 30 hours if everything else were the same. But would it be the same? If we worked 30 hours instead of 40, what would be the effect on our output? We'd produce substantially less, on the order of only 3/4. And if we produce 3/4, even if we earned the same weekly incomes, you know, the unions would like a shorter week, and they'd like at the same time to raise hourly rates so that you'd earn the same per week. Well, let's say that that actually happened. Suppose we have unchanged weekly incomes. The only problem is that because 3/4 as much is produced, there's 4/3 the prices. Well, then where are you with the same weekly incomes? You are only getting 3/4 the real wage. Now, isn't that a shock? You work 3/4 and you end up getting 3/4. Now, It's the same thing with child labor. Child labor is a terrible thing, especially for very young children. But what eliminated it was the rise in the productivity of labor. After all, who decided whether or not a child would work? The parents, except for orphan children. That's a special case. But in the immense majority of cases, it was the parents. Now, as the real earnings of the parents rose, then they could afford to keep their children home longer and longer. So if you look at literature, the movies, whatever, in 1800, maybe children were going to work as young as six. By 1850, maybe it would be eight or nine. By 1900, maybe 10 or 12. Now, sometimes 25. So,
sometimes longer.
A little longer. This is the result of the productivity of labor, and as the real earnings of the parents go up, and they need less and less contribution from the children, then child labor disappears. But suppose you have a miserably poor population that can barely survive, and they need the labor of their children, and then you prevent the children from working at all. What's the effect on the standard of living of already miserably poor people?
They're
more impoverished. So such legislation can work to make poor people poorer.
Then there's government subsidy to offset that.
Well, then you say government subsidies, but where do the subsidies come from? The subsidies come from other workers or from the hated capitalists, and in that case, they're generally coming at the expense of the demand for capital goods and labor. Okay, well now, if we can keep in mind that it's the productivity of labor that explains why conditions were bad, why wages were so low, and the same analysis applies to working conditions. There are many improvements in working conditions that just hadn't taken place generations back. No one could work with electric light before it was invented. Then there are things which are known. But again and again, there are situations where installing them adds to cost, but doesn't add sufficiently to productivity, so it's a rise in costs. Now, that doesn't mean the workers couldn't have them. Suppose there's something that makes a job easier, more enjoyable, more comfortable for the workers, but it doesn't contribute significantly to output. So from the perspective of the employer, it's just an added cost. In what circumstances would an employer be willing to incur that cost, where it would actually be much to his interest to do so?
The increase in productivity.
Now, let's say there is no increase in productivity, or it's not significant. Well,
maintains the labor force?
Well, there you're saying it's needed to keep the workers. But let's say that he's paying a competitive wage. If the workers truly value such an improvement, then they can have it without increasing the employer's employment costs. But by what means? What's required so that employees could have the benefit of certain improvements that are for their comfort without increasing the employment costs? Without the productivity hasn't risen, and this isn't going to raise it. Pardon me? A decrease in their take-home wages. The employees can have improvements in their conditions that simply add to costs if they compensate by accepting a relatively lower take-home wage. Now, again and again this happens, and let me show you how it works to the interest of the employer. In a country like the United States, the average level of real wages is already very, very high, and probably in most cases, if a worker has to choose between working in the summer in an office that's air-conditioned and one that's a sweat box, if he's able to earn $500 a week, if that's his base earnings, and he detests working in the sweat box, well, mightn't he be perfectly willing to accept perhaps $20 less a week to work in the air-conditioned office? Suppose you see a job offer, and you realize this is a sweat box. You can get $500 in an air-conditioned office. In order to work in the sweat box, you might want $540 or $550 or more. Well, suppose the cost of installing the air conditioning to the employer works out to be $5 per worker per week. That's his cost, $5 per worker per week. He doesn't have to install it, but if he wants workers to come and work for him and they can obtain air conditioned comfort somewhere else, what kind of premium would he have to pay? Well, he'd have to pay a substantial premium to compensate the workers. If that premium is more than $5 per worker per week, what does it pay him to do?
Install
the air conditioning. Now, the workers could have that $5 per week, but they're willing, they insist on $20 or $50 more per week to work in a sweat box.
Right.
Now, suppose we transpose the same example to a place like Bangladesh. And let's assume the cost of air conditioning someplace in Bangladesh is also $5 per worker per week, but there the total earnings of the worker are $25 per week. And the worker could have the comfort of an air-conditioned office, but he'd have to accept $5 a week less in take-home pay. Well, do you think that he's in a position to afford to take that kind of reduction?
No.
Not at all. So they can't afford it. In the United States, the workers can afford far more than the cost of having the improvement. Yes, Ms. Herrera?
But wouldn't it benefit the employer to put the ACE, even if they have a sweat box, because people that are comfortable working will produce better?
Well, they may produce more. Well, let's grant that. But if they don't produce enough to cover the cost, then it's not something that pays for itself. See, when you have improvements in conditions that do pay for themselves, then they will be introduced automatically in the same way that any improvement is introduced. There are many people who don't think so, because they think, they seem to say that if something makes life easier for the workers, the employer won't do it precisely because of that. But they would certainly do it if it paid for itself. But we're talking about situations where there are improvements that don't pay for themselves, but they can still be introduced if the workers are willing to take a sufficiently less take-home pay to cover their costs. And again, it's the case that in order to get them without such an improvement, you'd have to pay them a premium substantially greater than the cost of the improvement. Yes, Mr. Wright.
Would you apply this concept, please, to the recent grocery store workers' strike, where the cost of health insurance was going to rise? They're really refusing to come to work, even though it was a relatively small increment.
Yeah. I would say it applies to the grocery workers' strike and to all fringe benefits of all workers. Whatever the employer is paying for you for health insurance, you could conceivably have as take-home wages. Now, we have it this way at present. That part of your income is tax exempt. And if you're uninsured, you're dumped into a tank of piranha, in effect. So health insurance appears as a vital necessity. But all of these fringe costs, the employer's contribution to Social Security, Medicare, whatever, paid holidays, no one is paying you for not working. These are all part of the employment costs, and all of these things are what workers could have as take-home wages. Yes, Mr. Mendez.
One example of that would be a lot of times when larger corporations hire people as consultants, they'll hire at a higher rate. If they were converted to a permanent employee because the overhead, they'll hire them at a much less rate.
Oh, that's a very good observation, because when they're working as consultants, the company doesn't have to pay these additional costs. So, but when they hire them as an employee, they deduct those additional costs. That's a very helpful observation. Thank you. Okay. Well, if we can hold these things in mind, now we have the context in which we can discuss reductions in wage rates that are needed to eliminate unemployment. We don't have to be concerned that if the market is free to have such reductions, that this means a system in which wage rates will go to minimum subsistence. Now, the way mass unemployment is typically precipitated there is a financial contraction, a drop in spending, and what brings this about is a prior process of inflation. I'm now referring to point two under B. I say inflation, artificial money creation, particularly in the form of credit expansion, particularly in the form of the increase in the quantity of money entering the economy in the form of new loans to business. As we saw some weeks ago, this process operates to reduce the demand for money for holding. It operates to raise the velocity of circulation. But what happens when this process comes to an end, or slows down, or sharply slows down? Then what will happen to the demand for money for holding?
It goes up.
Then the demand for money for holding will go up, and velocity comes down. There's less spending, and now this means there's suddenly less sales revenues, profit squeeze develops, cash flows shrink, and again and again, some major firms will go bankrupt. And what happens if some of these firms have major loans to banks? Some banks can go bankrupt too. And when that happens, what happens to the quantity of money? Then the quantity of money actually declines, and then you'll get a further rise in the demand for money for holding. This is the typical pattern of every depression. And this is what happened in 1929. Mr. Rosendahl.
My question is this: are we better protected by the Federal Reserve now against such depression?
Are we better protected against financial contraction? I would say yes. The Federal Reserve has the ability to create as many new and additional dollars as it may think necessary. What we're not protected against in any way is the continual depreciation of the value of the money. They continually expand the quantity of money. They openly announce that they actually desire that prices rise at some modest rate. They were unhappy with a zero rise in prices. They want there to be at least 1 or 2% every year. And the government always has this ability to create more money. And there are always new demands being made. Our current president introduces the prescription drug benefit. That adds untold hundreds of billions of dollars over the years. There's the war in Iraq. That's another major source. If his opponent is elected instead of him, then it's very possible we'll have some kind of national health insurance program, which can add still more trillions, and then there'll be further demands for other programs. So there's really no limit, and what allows this is the government's ability to create money. You see, the government has the printing press as a source of funds, and they don't have to get all of their money from the taxpayers. So this changes the whole relationship between the government and the citizens. If we had a gold monetary unit, and the government can't make gold, so where would it have to turn to get gold money? To the citizens. You see, the government spends money, but it doesn't earn money, right? So whatever money it may have, it's always disappearing. If the government is going to continue spending, it needs to get money from an outside source. It doesn't generate the money by its own activity if it can't print it. So it always would have to turn to the citizens. In that environment, if the government wanted to spend more, what would automatically be implied and recognized? They'd have to either raise taxes or cut other government programs. Now just think, how would the very language appear? The president is going to give us a prescription drug benefit. Well, how would that go over under a gold standard? The question would be, well, where are you getting the money? Yeah. Do you have an immense personal fortune that is going to pay for this? If the government is going to provide additional billions of dollars, they would have to raise taxes. So what do you think the popularity would be? Oh boy, we're getting a free prescription drug benefit, and we're going to pay the additional taxes to pay for it and the whole bureaucracy to administer it. Do you think people would be applauding this or viewing it as another boondoggle scheme to raise their taxes or maybe strip the national defense of the country to pay for it? So what do you think the likelihood of enactment of such a proposal would be? What do you think the enactment years ago, the likelihood of enacting Medicare and Medicaid would have been? I doubt that they could have gotten through. The enactment of new federal departments, the Department of Education, the Department of Energy, anything that's adding to government expenditures, if people understood that the additional spending means equivalent extra taxes or reduced government spending for more necessary functions like national defense, what do you think would have been implied about the growth in the size of government? It could not have taken place on the scale to which it has. It would have had a much harder battle. But when the government has the ability to create money, then it can say to the people, oh yeah, we're giving you a new prescription drug benefit. Why? Well, must the government get the additional money from the taxpayers? No, they can manufacture the money. They have their own independent sources of funds, their own independent source of funds. Now, this means that the government is no longer financially dependent on the citizens. You see, in a free country, the citizens are supreme. The government is the servant. But to make that real, the government has to be financially dependent on the citizens. Instead, under our present arrangement, most of the citizens think they're financially dependent on the government. Why do they think that? Because the government has its own source of money. This is an enormously important issue. And it's the ability to create money, which in the past was always on a much lesser scale. In the past, money could be created up to a certain point, and then it had to come to a screeching halt. And when it did, that's what precipitated the recession or depression. Now we have an arrangement where when a recession or depression is starting to develop, the government starts expanding money more rapidly. And they can avoid the recession or depression or reduce the severity of it. But as time goes on, the government keeps getting bigger and bigger, adopting more programs, taking on more functions. So this is our situation. Now, in the past, what would precipitate depressions would be, first, there's a process of limited inflation. That operates to reduce the demand for money for holding, raise velocity, but then it had to stop because the money was, after all, tied to gold, and you couldn't expand the quantity of money too far beyond the supply of gold. And when that was threatened, the process stopped. But when it stopped, the demand for money for holding had to rebuild, which meant velocity would fall, there'd be a contraction of spending, and then with a fractional reserve banking system, you could start having bank failures and an actual reduction in the quantity of money. Yes, Mr. Rosenthal.
Two more questions. In the 60s, didn't we have a more severe depression than even in the 30s?
In the 60s, did we have a more serious depression than in
the 30s? But the government increased the supply of money or maintained the supply of money enough to keep it from becoming too severe, or
what would you say there? Well, when you say a more serious depression, I'd be surprised that you would think so.
I think I read that in the book, in your book.
That there was a more serious depression in the
1960s? Yeah, in the early
60s. Boy, I'm amazed. I have no knowledge of having written that. I don't think it's something I would say.
Okay.
It's conceivable a more serious depression had the potential to develop.
Okay.
That's possible. A more serious depression has the potential now, but that doesn't mean that it will actually come to pass. The government all along keeps expanding the quantity of money. Yes, Mr. Whitesides.
Well, Professor, you're scaring me here. I mean, you seem to be this like all-knowing, you know, capitalist guru, right?
Yeah.
And we're in a democratic like society here. We're supposed to, you know, vote into office the right person so they make the right decisions, or at least, you know, lead up the committee or the, you know, cabinet that makes the right decisions or helps us make the right decisions.
Right.
So, do you vote?
Yeah, I vote. I vote at least against most of the propositions.
Right.
Oh, but not necessarily for candidates.
Not necessarily for every office. And I really
so
don't
vote against every single proposition.
No, I wouldn't say every single proposition, but anyone that would add taxes. To taxes or anything of that kind.
Interesting.
Yes, Mr. Oh, I'm sorry, let me get Ms. Yang. She hasn't had a chance yet. Yes.
There's a proposition, I think 68. How does that relate to employment? I think it has to do with how government restrict asking small business to acquire health care for the workers, even if they're on part-time.
Is that 68? I thought 68 was the Indian casinos.
It's probably 70-something.
I haven't heard of that proposition. I have a voter's pamphlet at home. I have to read all the propositions.
Okay, basically it's telling the companies to either purchase health care for part-time workers, either through a government agency or through a private insurance company.
Okay, mandating health care coverage
right.
by private employers. How do you guys think, what do you think the effect would be? What is it the equivalent of if the government is imposing a program that employers now have to pay for? Yes, Mr. Weatherford? Okay, it should end up doing that, but what is it tantamount to in the first instance?
Same as tax. It's the same as tax.
Isn't it essentially the same? It's an additional cost that employers are supposed to incur on behalf of their employees, right? So how does that differ from a government-mandated wage increase?
It doesn't.
Isn't it essentially the same thing?
Yeah.
All right, then the question to ask is, what would be the effect of the government imposing an arbitrary rise in wage rates for any category of workers? That'll mean there'll be fewer people employed, and what would be required to continue to have the same number employed, given that a higher total wage means fewer employed?
Everybody leave the state.
Pardon me? The take-home wages would have to fall. If we were to have the same employment with the employers paying for the added cost, that would end up being at the expense of the workers. Otherwise, there's unemployment. So, is this to the actual advantage of the workers? You see, the mentality of the people who propose such a proposition is that there's this bottomless fund, the profits of the capitalists, and they'll just take more out of the profits. Now, they've taken it 500 times already, and they don't seem to realize that nothing is lastingly taken out of profits.
The cost of goods sold.
They're increasing the cost, and who ends up paying the burden of higher costs? It's the consumers. If all of these programs were in fact paid for out of profits, profits would have disappeared generations ago. There can be a temporary drop in profits, but pretty soon it'll be passed on in higher prices, or that the industry will go out of existence.
Interesting.
But let's say that the companies do purchase programs from the government.
Okay, let's say they purchase it from the government. Now,
doesn't government have more negotiating power to reduce the cost of health care?
Well, let's say they're going to buy some program from the government. The private employer will have to enroll in a government program. Well, still he has the added cost. Then there's the further question, where will the government get the money to finance its contribution? That will mean higher taxes. Certainly at the state level, the state of California, no state has the ability to create money. So they would have to raise taxes or cut other expenditures. They still are under that constraint. And if they're raising taxes, whose taxes will it be? That'll end up mainly being the taxes that fall on the average wage earner. Then maybe they'll raise the sales tax, they'll have to charge extra fees, whatever. Yes, Mr. Boisseau.
How does the hire of workers' comp here in California, how does that relate? Is that government imposed or is that the insurance agency?
Say that again?
The hire workers' comp in California, how it's affecting the businesses, especially small businesses. Is that a government fee, or is that like an insurance company charge?
Well, the government mandates that employers have the workers' compensation program. And so that's something that also ends up at the cost of the wage earners. Did you want to make an observation, Mr. Weatherford?
Several.
Okay.
Number one, it's helpful to remember that this is not a democracy, it's a representative republic. We do not elect a president, we elect an electoral college.
Yeah.
You know, winner takes all state. Number two, government-run health care.
Yeah.
Please show me a program outside of possibly defense that the government has proven it can do better than the private citizens or private government. So far, the private sector can do much better than the government in almost every circumstance.
Yeah, I agree with that, and I would say that's also true in healthcare, but things don't have that appearance, because if you're a private individual and you're thrust out to seek medical care without insurance, you're literally in a situation where you're cannibalized. You get these incredible charges.
Right.
Well, there would have to be some things done to break this down. I don't know if I've discussed this, but I'll just name it now. We have like $2,000 a day hospital stays. Do we have any discussion of this?
No.
Okay. Now, if you've ever stopped to think, what does it cost to spend a night in a pretty good hotel?
$500.
Well, that would be the very top of the line. You can stay probably about $150. I know I have a reservation at the LAX Hilton sometime in December.
Oh, we can't class?
No, it's after. No such luck. And that will come about $150. Now, if you start looking at things like that and you figure, okay, suppose we got a hotel and we'll have round-the-clock nursing service for however many nurses we need to look after a reasonable number of patients. And we're concerned not with the esoteric, super complicated cases like kidney transplants or things like that, but things like appendectomies, pneumonia, more or less run-of-the-mill cases. Suppose we gave the freedom to physicians, already licensed physicians, so people don't have to worry that someone off the street will do this. Suppose any three licensed physicians were given the legal right to start their own hospital and concentrate on those particular ailments that they were competent in. So they might refuse to accept certain types of cancer patients. But what do you think would happen to the costs of routine problems like pneumonia, appendectomies, and so forth? Starting with, do you think a level of $2,000 a day could be maintained if your actual level of cost required was only $500 a day? So the competition would make these rates plunge. And then you could have a further reform. We have a problem with uninsured people. They need special help. Suppose you need to get around this problem of horrendous malpractice insurance. We didn't always have such a problem. It's got to have been the result of changes in the law and judicial interpretations over a period of years. Suppose we allowed uninsured patients to go by a different, earlier standard. They could opt out, they could contract out of the present system with the hospital. What would that do to costs? I think that would bring it way down. If you didn't have this kind of horrendous malpractice arrangement, that would operate to bring costs down. And if you have it now between the patient and the provider, and you got the HMOs and the others out of the picture, then the physicians and hospitals know that the procedures they're providing, that has to be paid for by the patient. What do you think that'll do to the kinds of treatments they prescribe? They'll have to make it affordable. See, we've gotten where we are because we have essentially collectivized the cost of healthcare. Let me illustrate this principle. Suppose after this class, we all go out to the nearest restaurant or bar, and we'll have a late night snack. And the arrangement will be everyone orders whatever they want from the menu, and then we'll split the check 30 ways. What do you think would happen to the size of the check compared to people each paying for themselves?
It would be much larger.
I think it would end up being much, much larger. Well, health insurance, in quotes, it's not really insurance, it's the collectivized payment of medical expenses. Now, that's a similar arrangement. and it keeps going up, because the individual and his physician, they can have things that benefit them, but if you're dividing the cost among a group of several million people, what is the cost to the individual? It's insignificant. If everyone is doing it, then the cost will be much, much higher. But for any given individual, there's no perceptible increase in the cost. So this is the basis of the runaway costs, and this underlies also the malpractice problem, because it's an implicit standard that everybody is entitled to state-of-the-art medical care, and anything less is malpractice. I'll take this just this one question on it, then I want to go back to unemployment.
You're really in my arena now. Problem is, in the pre-HMO era, it's an absolute fact that the number of unnecessary procedures performed and the lengths of stays were significantly greater than they are now. Now, I'm not a proponent of HMOs.
Right.
But, you know, tonsillectomies are down to like one-tenth of what they were in the 1970s and early 1980s.
Okay, but you see, the HMOs are a response. The HMOs are a response to the runaway rise in costs that the collectivization of medical care brings about. And the way it starts, you see, first, for some years, the physicians could prescribe anything, and many of them would benefit because they make money on it too. And the patients were getting whatever they wanted. But now we're getting into the HMOs, and they're getting worse and worse. Think of it this way. Suppose you start off and you have an arrangement. A stranger is responsible for buying you lunch every day. Now, where do you think you're going to end up? Will you be eating a sirloin steak or something closer to dog food? You see, it may start out as sirloin steak, but it's going to end up as dog food. And that's where we are with the HMOs. Because they do want to control the expenses, and the arrangement gives no reason to the individual to do so. Okay, let me turn back now to unemployment. So if we have a financial contraction precipitated on a foundation of prior inflation, the decline in spending results in smaller quantities of goods purchased and smaller quantities of labor required to produce the smaller quantities of goods purchased. So we get unemployment. This is how the unemployment comes into existence, as the result of the drop in the general level of spending. Now, when and if the level of spending stabilizes, and it would tend to stabilize at some point, there'd be a lesser level of spending, but it does not drop indefinitely. It does stabilize at some lower level. At the lower level of spending, that lower level of spending is capable of buying all the goods and services that can be produced at the point of full employment and of employing the whole labor force. What is required for a lesser expenditure for consumers' goods and a lesser volume of payrolls to buy as many consumers' goods as the previously greater level of spending did and as the previously greater level of payrolls did? I'm sorry, I'm hearing productivity somewhere, and I'm hearing any different answer. Yeah, what's required for a smaller amount of spending to buy as much as a previously greater amount of spending? The prices have to drop. Prices have to drop. What's required, think of it this way, what's required for $80 at a later time to buy as much as $100 used to buy?
Price drops by 20%.
The prices fall by 20%. What's required for $4 trillion of payrolls to employ as many workers as $5 trillion used to. If wage rates drop by 20%. So when there is a financial contraction, once the contraction stabilizes at the lower level, it is certainly possible to get back to full employment and full production on the foundation of a fall in wage rates and prices. The lower wage rates and prices permit the same reduced levels of spending to employ all just as much as the previously greater levels of spending. The way I put it here, under point A, under 4, the same aggregate money demand for labor can be stretched to pay an indefinitely larger number of workers at inversely proportionate wage rates. And we have an illustration of this. Here's the demand for labor. This is the same as the productionist aggregate demand curve. Here's the supply of labor representing full employment. So there's a definite wage at which full employment is possible. Here it's the wage 1.0. Right, with this same demand for labor, what would be the effect on employment if the wage level were jacked up to double?
Half.
We'd have half the employment. We'd have 50% unemployment. What if the wage level were cut from 1.0 to 0.5? Then we'd have an incredible labor shortage. We'd have twice the jobs offered as there were people to fill them. So notice the difference between mass unemployment, full employment, and a labor shortage. What is determining the difference given the demand for labor? The wage level. With the same quantity of money, the same ability to meet payrolls, it's possible to have mass unemployment if the wage level is too high, full employment if it's appropriate, or a labor shortage if the wage level is below the full employment point. So it's all a question of adjusting the wage rates to the demand for labor. Now, notice, and I think this is brought out by some of the questioners in the class, as we employ more people, if we have lower wage rates and employ more people, what is happening to the production and supply of goods?
Increasing.
That's increasing. And what will be happening to the prices of goods, whether you look at it as determined by the larger supply or by the lower costs?
Decreasing.
The prices will fall. And this is what I say in point B. The fall in wage rates and rise in employment reduces prices, output is expanded, and prices fall as the result of the larger supply. Also, the larger supply is produced at lower unit costs because of the fall in wage rates. Thus, prices fall both because of more supply and lower production costs, either way you look at it. And notice, wage rates are the fundamental cost in the economic system. If you think of something like the cost of producing an automobile, how do wage rates directly and indirectly influence or determine the cost of producing an automobile? At what points do they determine it? Pardon me?
Maybe what parts you want to put on.
All right, how do the wage rates connect with the parts?
Like demand.
How labor intensive it is.
Well, what about the cost of producing the parts?
Okay,
the wage rates are a major element in the cost of producing the parts. They're a major element in the automobile factories, in the production of the automobiles. They also enter as a major cost of producing the steel that goes into the cars. They're another major cost of mining the iron ore that is used to make the steel. As a matter of fact, suppose we had a completely vertically integrated automobile company that was producing its own steel, its own iron ore, and everything else directly or indirectly required to produce an automobile. What would be the only costs of such a firm? Essentially the wages. The wages are the prime element in costs. And if wage rates fall, it's not only the fall that takes place within a given firm, but also the fall in wage rates paid by the suppliers of that firm that will operate to lower its cost of materials and parts and so forth. And so a fall in wage rates will have an effect on prices, all the costs in the economy, and on and prices correspondingly. Now, I turn to some major implications of this process. And this is point 5, and I say in point A, that average business profitability is not reduced by virtue of this fall in prices. Why not? Well, the fall in prices is preceded by a fall in unit cost to the same extent. And what's bringing about the fall in cost is the fall in wage rates. And to carry this point further, and we'll be dealing with profits very extensively after the midterm, and this can be a good introduction to aggregate profitability in the economy. We know on the basis of common sense accounting that profit is the difference between sales and costs. Now, there is a common component in the costs and the sales, which is the sales revenues for things like materials, machinery, and so forth. The sales revenues coming in exchange for materials, machinery, means any means of production, any produced means of production, they show up in sales revenues. And where else do the same sorts of expenditures show up? Where, in other words, would the expenditure for steel sheet show up in the economy? It's a sales revenue to the steel producer. What is it to the producers of automobiles and refrigerators? It's a cost. It's a cost. So a major component of sales revenues has a close correspondent with an equally major component of costs, namely all those sales revenues which represent receipts from the sale of capital goods, receipts from the sale of materials, machinery, spare parts, anything of this kind. All of these sales revenues will show up as costs in the future, and the costs that are showing up today are the reflection of prior such expenditures. Now, suppose we had an economy in which the amount of money spent to buy all the various capital goods was unchanged for many years. So the total expenditure to buy things like steel sheet, tires to put on new cars, the paint to paint them, the plate glass to make them, and similarly in all branches of the economy. Suppose these outlays were the same year in and year out. What would be implied about the extent to which these outlays would show up as costs? Yeah, what would be implied if we had a constant level of expenditure for materials and machinery, if that were an unchanged level of expenditure year in and year out? We'd have sales revenues always equal to that much, right? And what would we also have?
Costs.
We'd have costs. We'd have costs to the same extent. We'd have a tendency for this part of sales revenues to equal the corresponding part of costs. The sales revenues generated by the purchase of materials and machinery would tend to equal the costs generated from prior purchases of materials and machinery. Now, if that's the case, what simplification is possible when we express profits as sales minus costs? Aren't we in a position then?
That's a break even at that point.
Well, what happens if we subtract out that part of sales which represents receipts from the sale of capital goods and that part of costs which reflects the expenditure to buy capital goods? Well, we'd still have something minus something, right? What part of sales, what is the other part of sales? Where does it come from insofar as sales don't reflect expenditure for capital goods of some kind? Pardon me?
Finished products,
the consumer's goods.
You still have the cost for the original raw material.
Well, what element of cost would we still have if we subtract out cost on account of all the capital goods?
We'd have labor.
Now, the overhead, that reflects outlays for such things as advertising, depreciation on buildings and so forth. But if we had the same outlays for advertising, their revenues to the advertising agencies, their cost to the advertisers, the depreciation and the annual expenditure for capital goods, they tend to equalize. So what would happen is we'd have profits reducing to the difference between spending to buy consumers' goods and the payment of wages. So it would be subtracting out of sales revenues that part of sales revenues which comes from the purchase of capital goods, and we'd be subtracting out of costs that part of costs which also comes from the purchase of capital goods. So profits would reduce to consumption minus wages. Now, if that stays the same, then profits stay the same. And let's assume that. We're assuming now, we've been working, when we looked at real wages, we used formulas for the price level and a formula for the wage level. And our formula for the price level was demand for consumers' goods divided by the supply of consumers' goods. The formula for the wage level was demand for labor divided by the supply of labor. Well, now what we can realize further is that if we take the difference between those two numerators, the demand for consumers' goods and the demand for labor, what have we got? At least as an approximation.
Profit.
We have aggregate profit in the economy. Now, if these two magnitudes were to remain the same, even at a lower level, if they stabilize at a lower level, then what is implied about aggregate profit in the economy? Let's put numbers on it. Suppose we'll call the demand for consumers' goods 500, the demand for labor 400. Then each unit can represent many tens of billions of dollars. Then aggregate profit would be 100 of these units. Now, would it matter how much labor was employed? Suppose the same demand for labor employed a larger quantity of labor because wage rates fell.
No,
the total labor cost would be the same. We'd have, what would be the effect though on unit labor cost? If we're employing more people at lower wage rates, the total labor cost is the same, but certainly the labor cost, as far as it comes from any one worker, that's less. And now, suppose we have, let's say we're employing 10% more people. Imagine that we have a drop in wage rates of, we'll have to make the percentages consistent. Suppose we start off, we've reached a point where there's 10% unemployment. We have 10% unemployment. And the demand for labor and the demand for capital goods have both stabilized at a lower level. Let's say here's our demand for labor. We'll say it's stable at 400. The demand for consumers' goods is stable at 500. But initially, we have 10% unemployment. Okay, what will be required to allow this unchanged 400 of demand for labor to employ the 10% of workers who are unemployed? If our initial position is we're employing 9 workers out of 10, and we want to get to the point where instead of employing 9 workers, we're employing 10 workers, if we're replacing 9 with 10, what ratio of increase is that? Well, it's 10 to 9. It's 10 ninths. Full employment would represent employing 10 ninths the supply of labor. We would have 10 ninths the supply of labor. Well, what would have to happen to wage rates to permit the same demand for labor to employ 10 ninths the supply?
Increase the wage.
How much? What would have to be the average money wage? 9/10. If the average wage is 9/10, well, the same payrolls at 9/10 the wage can employ 10/9 the workers, and we'd have full employment. Okay, now, if we have 10/9 the workers working, if their output per worker were the same, if the output per worker is the same, what will be the effect on the supply of consumers' goods?
10/9.
That would be 10/9. if the demand for consumers' goods is unchanged, what will have to happen to prices for the same expenditure for consumers' goods to buy 10/9 the output? I'm sorry? Prices would have to be 9/10 too. Now, if wages are 9/10 and prices are 9/10, what is implied about real wages? Pardon me? Well, have they increased? If you were originally earning $1,000 a week and buying at a price level we'll call 100%, now you're earning $900 a week and you're buying at a price level we'll call 90%, your wage would be the same to that extent. Now, so you'd have unchanged real wages. Money wages would fall, but real wages would be unchanged. We've shown that profits, or I hope we've showed that profits would be unchanged. After all, if this is 400 and this is 500 and they stay there, will it matter what the physical volume of labor employed and the volume of goods produced is? If we're employing 10/9 the labor for the same 400 and producing and selling 10/9 the goods for the same 500, what's aggregate profit?
100.
It's still 100, right? So there's nothing that reduces aggregate profit or implicitly the average rate of profit. And we've just seen also that real wages would not fall because prices would be falling to the same extent as wages. What would be the significant thing that had changed? We'd have eliminated the unemployment. We'd have eliminated the unemployment. Now, that elimination of unemployment can indirectly contribute to a rise in real wages, but a rise in take-home wages. And the way to see this is to just consider when we have the 10% unemployment, these people are being supported. Presumably, they're not starving to death in the streets. They're being maintained. And who is paying the cost? It's mainly the people who are employed. Now, it might be that they're voluntarily helping an unemployed friend or brother or something of that kind, or they're paying taxes to do it. So one way or another, the burden of supporting the unemployed is falling on the people who are employed. Now, when we eliminate the unemployment, what presumably should happen to this burden? That should be eliminated. And then we can see how real take-home wages actually rise. See, when we started out, when you're earning the initial wage, let's say you're making $1,000 a week, if there's unemployment and you're having to help support the unemployed, well, suppose you're having to pay $50 a week out of your $1,000, you're contributing to the support of the 10% who are unemployed. So what then is your actual take-home wage after meeting this cost? It's only $9.50. Now, in this process, when your money wage falls from $1,000 to $900 and the prices that you have to pay fall from 100% to 90%, in this process, the wage that you take home is going to be 90. Your gross wage falls from 100 to 90, but your take-home wage has fallen only from 950 to 900. Why? Because the burden of supporting the unemployed is eliminated. So your take-home wage falls actually less than the prices do, and it's from that perspective that there's a rise in real take-home wages. You've eliminated the burden of supporting the unemployed. Now, to assure you as to the substance of the principle, let's take the same sort of example on a desert island. Let's imagine we have 10 shipwrecked sailors, and they represent their own self-contained economy on this desert island. And assume that one of the sailors breaks a leg, and that incapacitates him for a while. And presumably the other 9 who are working will support this 10th one while he's incapacitated. All right, what is the effect on the other 9 when this 10th one recovers and can go back to work? Will that lower their standard of living or raise it?
Raise it.
It'll raise it, because they no longer need to support him. They can keep for themselves what they had been giving him. Now, nothing fundamental has changed if we were to introduce into this desert island some money. And let's imagine that on this desert island, there's a fixed limited fund to buy the output of these sailors, and there's a fixed limited fund to pay their wages. And when this sailor is laid up with his broken leg, there's 9 sailors competing for the limited wage fund. When he recovers, there'll be 10. So what should happen to the money wage per sailor? It'll fall. It should be 9/10 of what it was. But what happens to their output when there's 10 of them working instead of 9? Their output should now be higher in the ratio of 10 to 9. And what should happen to the prices of this output if it's sold for the same limited quantity of money? The price should be 9/10. Well, the money wage of the sailors would be 9/10. The prices were 9/10. Where's the net gain? They no longer have to support the 10th guy. He supports himself. It's the saving of the burden of supporting the unemployed. Now, this is a significant case. There are many, many people, when they look at something and they see that it might entail a reduction in wages, they automatically recoil from it and think, this has got to be bad. It can't be allowed. But here we are, we have a case, there's a reduction in wages, and what is the effect when the dust has settled? The standard of living is actually improved, because part of the same process is also an increase in production, a reduction in costs and prices, and the elimination of the burden of supporting the unemployed. So this, I suppose, comes under the heading of what Hazlitt was talking about when he says an economist has to look at the effects of all on all the relevant groups, indirect as well as direct. Now, let's go further with this. And consider what would operate to bring about such an outcome. What would bring about precisely this outcome in a free labor market? Let's say here we are, we've had a monetary system that is seriously flawed. It allows limited inflation up to a point, then it stops, and then we have the bust phase, the financial contraction, we have unemployment. Now there's unemployment. How would we get out of the unemployment in a free labor market? What would be the process that would force wage rates down? Well, what is the self-interest of the unemployed workers who need to work to live? I mean, they're willing to go to work for lower wages. They're willing to outcompete workers who have jobs by offering to accept lower pay. What's the self-interest of the employers in a situation of this kind where there are unemployed workers capable of replacing their present employees? To compel their present employees to take a cut to avoid being replaced. Now, this process appears to be a competition for the present number of jobs, but as it drives down wage rates, what's it doing to the number of workers that the same payroll funds can employ? It's enlarging the number of workers that the same payroll funds can employ. So that's how employment gets expanded. The competition for jobs by the unemployed in driving down wage rates has the effect of expanding the quantity demanded and eliminating the unemployment. And this is how, again and again, whenever we would get into a recession or depression, the economy would then proceed to recover. There'd be a fall in wage rates, costs, and prices, and pretty soon we'd be back to full employment and full production. This didn't happen in 1929, because for the first time there were major obstacles imposed against the fall in wage rates. And these obstacles came into play before the New Deal. They came into play under President Hoover, who is often regarded as a do-nothing, laissez-faire president, but he was very, very far from that. There was major intervention in the labor market from the Hoover White House, and he actively intervened to prevent the fall in wage rates, and was boasting that his administration, for the first time, had stopped wage rates from falling in the midst of unemployment. Now, why did he do such a thing? Because he had accepted the idea that became very popular in the 1920s that it's economically harmful to reduce wage rates because now the wage earners can't buy as much as they used to with their lower wages. Now, that's true for an individual wage earner, but it overlooks the fact that the extra wage earners employed will make up for the loss on the part of the individual wage earner. If we have wage rates falling 10% and more, and 10/9 the workers working, well, each individual worker is spending 10% less, but there are 10 workers doing that spending instead of 9, and we've eliminated the unemployment. Now, for some reason, Hoover and others didn't see that, and the unions didn't want to see it. And I believe Hoover was actually introduced at an AFL convention, got a very good reception, because he had worked to prevent the fall in wage rates, and whoever kept their jobs, well, they were doing much better, because there were some considerable reductions in prices. But if you keep your job, then you're getting the benefit of the fire sale prices, and your real wages are higher. But it's nothing to be happy about if you're without a job. Well, there are, I refer to this under point C, under 7, government pressure, President Hoover's White House conferences in the 1929 Depression. He called White House conferences that were attended by the heads of the leading corporations and got them to agree not to take advantage of the unemployment to cut wages any faster than prices had fallen. And then that was later on added to by extending pro-union legislation. We already had some powerful unions by the end of the 20s. The unions were very, very powerful in the construction industry and in the railroads. Those were their two main areas. And then in the 1930s, in the midst of the mass unemployment, the labor union movement spread, and many new industries were organized for the first time. There was labor legislation introduced in 1932, the Norris-LaGuardia Act. That prevented employers from getting federal court injunctions against mass picketing and labor union intimidation and violence. And then in 1933, there was the National Recovery Act, the NRA, and it included features that allowed the unions to go ahead and organize, encourage them to organize. It introduced such provisions as if the majority of workers at an establishment vote to join a union, the employer is compelled to recognize the union and to bargain with it. The National Labor Relations Act was subsequently, the National Recovery Act, the National Recovery Act was subsequently found unconstitutional by the Supreme Court, but then all of its essential provisions with respect to unions and wage earners were reimposed by the Wagner Act of 1935. And this is where we got the National Labor Relations Board from, the dates from that era, and unfair labor practices and so forth. So between unions, minimum wage laws, direct government interference along the lines of Hoover, also to the extent that public relief and welfare becomes available, and in some cases, no doubt, employer altruism. These are elements that stand in the way of a fall in wage rates, or simply flat out forcibly prevent it. And when you have such things, and there has been a financial contraction, well, if that's the way things stand, then what's going to happen to the amount of unemployment that we have?
Goes up.
It'll just remain huge. It'll be perpetuated indefinitely. And we have a similar problem today in some countries, not as severe, but nevertheless substantial. What is the unemployment rate in places like France and Germany?
11%.
On the order of 11%, 10%, double digits, in the low double digits. And they're locked into that. Why? Because they have very, very powerful labor union movements, much more powerful than here, and much more government support to maintain wage rates. And a major part of their wage scales consists of all kinds of fringes. There are tremendous benefits that the employers are compelled to pay. A lot of people boast the average German worker, I think, gets a 4 weeks vacation. The average American worker gets only 2 weeks or whatever. But what do you think something like that implies about labor costs, or the cost of employment of an individual worker per unit of labor that he performs? It adds to it. All of the paid holidays, the paid leaves, many people think these are just free benefits. I just get them for free. They come out of Santa Claus's sled. And they don't realize that there's a cost to someone. And one of the consequences is that you have a chronic unemployment problem. Now, they could reduce their unemployment, they could eliminate it, but either they would have to get rid of some of these fringe benefit programs, or they'd have to have a reduction in take-home pay, neither of which they're willing to do. So they perpetuate their problem of unemployment.